I'm Tim Deer Jones. I have had a varied working career, but about 30 years ago, I got interested in marine pollution and took myself to university and did a degree in marine sciences at Cardiff University, which turned out to be very useful because our fieldwork backyard was the Bristol Channel. So I've had one way or another plenty of experience on the Bristol Channel. I did my marine science degree and I did a research dissertation on the sea to land transfer of marine radioactivity, which actually entailed spending some time on Flatholm Island in the middle of the Bristol Channel, which was good fun. And since then, since the mid-80s, I've been working as a marine pollution consultant with a major focus on hydrocarbon oil spills. Did the Sea Empress and the Erica, and some big spills like that, and on marine radioactivity. And latterly, I've had more and more of a focus on the fate and behavior in the environment of marine radioactivity. So that's my speciality. I've worked for most of the, as an independent, but I've done contract work for most of the UK's major marine NGOs and campaigning groups, and a number of marine campaigning groups elsewhere across Europe and into Australasia. I've had some of my work translated into Japanese and some of it into Kalalisat, which is the Greenland language, where I was working on the marine implications of uranium mining there. That's me. I got into this particular project in the Bristol Channel because I had done a lot of work on aggregate dredging in the Bristol Channel for various bodies back in the 90s. And I was just looking through the dredging license applications for the Bristol Channel in 2017. And I stumbled upon an application to the Welsh government to dump 300,000 tons of radioactive sediments from the outfall area of the Hinckley C proposed site, which of course is right next to Hinckley A and Hinckley B.
Hang on, because the Hinckley power station people would say that's not radioactive. You're saying it's radioactive.
Yeah, well, they got a kind of a legal sleight of hand, which said that because they could calculate that the, by their methodology, that the dose of radioactivity to people who would be exposed to the sediments during dredging and post-dredging was so low that under a legal definition concocted by the International Atomic Energy Agency and agreed by European governments, they could declare that radioactivity as de minimis status, which means of no account. And so they are saying that under law, actually, if you look at their phrasing, they're saying under law, it is not radioactivity, which is a clever form of words, of course, because when you delve down, it does indicate that there is radioactivity there. And they did that on the basis of what I would regard as some rather poor methodology.
How do the levels in this mud compared to background radiation? I think that's what most of us want to know.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, background radiation becomes, sorry to be so obscure and argumentative, but background radiation itself becomes a bit of an issue because currently background radiation isn't actually just purely natural radioactivity, which is one story that we all accept because that's been there since the year dot, you know, since the planet was formed. But background radioactivity actually also apparently includes radioactive fallout from atom nuclear bomb testing, Chernobyl cloud, Sellafield accidents, and historical discharges. So that's a bit of a misnomer anyway. But the problem for us, Tony, was that when we actually looked at this application in terms of aggregated radioactivity, there were many millions of becquerels, which is a radioactive unit, of radioactivity in that mud, especially if they were going to be dumping 300,000 tons of it. So we just really wanted to ask for baseline data, and there was no evidence that anybody had actually measured along the Welsh coast or at sites on the Somerset coast, you know, 12 miles further out from the Hinckley site, to see what the levels of radioactivity were there before any dumping was done. So in 2017, when I discovered this, I launched a petition asking the Welsh government, could they arrange for baseline data analysis to be done? So that there were four things we wanted to know. What amount of man-made radioactivity from Hinckley and the other reactors on the Bristol Channel, because there are other, there were others, was there actually in the mud that existed before dumping along the Welsh coast? Exactly how many radionuclides were there? Was there any evidence that coastal populations along the South Wales coast were in receipt of radioactive doses from seafoods or from marine air or from mucking about on the beach? Could anybody tell us that when the mud was dumped, where it would go after it was dumped? Because the proposed dump site was called a dispersal site, which meant that the stuff would move away from there. And Welsh Government and the Welsh Environmental Regulator and EDF, the nuclear company, all steadfastly refused to do any of that monitoring. So we fought that and we took it. Eventually, the Welsh Senedd Petition Committee did take aboard what we said and pushed it through to a plenary debate in the National Assembly of Wales. At that National Assembly, 8 of the 9 speakers called to speak supported our plea, but nonetheless the minister at the time granted the license to EDF to do the dumping, and so the dumping was done. And and we didn't have the finances or the wherewithal at that time to do our own sediment sampling.
Before you explain what you've been up to, 300,000 tons sounds like a lot, but actually when it comes to mud and water, this isn't actually necessarily a vast amount, really.
It's not so much the volume of mud as the radioactivity entrained within it. And there were additional problems, because we know, because the station, the Hinckley A and Hinckley B stations, have been there. Well, the Hinckley A was constructed during the 60s, and Hinckley B came along a decade or so later. But they have been discharging into that particular area of the Somerset coast, for over 50 years. And a list of material discharged from the station is published on a regular basis. So we know that there were over 50 different types of radioactivity, including things like plutonium, being discharged into the marine environment. And actually, EDF's analyses only analysed 3 of the man-made radionuclides that were discharged. And what did particularly concern us was that we know, because it's on record in Hansard, that Hinckley A was one of the reactors designed to produce plutonium for the UK and US weapons program. And we do know that there were a few, should we call them incidents, where radioactivity escaped unfiltered. And we feared that there were particles of plutonium had escaped at that stage.
Well, yeah, okay. So the nuclear industry says it's safe. The British government says it's safe. Well, who are you to contradict them?
We are a group. I am a qualified marine scientist with 30 years experience of poking around and looking at this thing. And I am actually supported by a lot of independent research, which is published in peer-reviewed journals on some of these issues that I'm concerned about. And I mean, the thing is, what really upset us and concerned us was the refusal of the nuclear industry and government agencies to oblige us and reassure public concern by actually undertaking the baseline data analyses that I referenced to you earlier.
Yes, so effectively what you're saying is we need to know how much radiation is around right now so that we can keep a very close eye on it to make sure it's not increasing.
Spot on.
So whereabouts have you been looking around and taking these samples? Because I think it's actually, you know, I like the idea of, you know, sort of switched on citizens with their Geiger counters or whatever it is they've got and test tubes and sampling, actually doing this kind of stuff for themselves. I wonder, are you just taking samples from the low water, the mud at the low water marks, or are you actually going out deeper?
No, we didn't have the finances or the technology to take seabed submarine, as it were, samples. So we were following a basic principle outlined by the government's official monitoring program, which is to monitor from spots along the shoreline, along the intertidal. So what we were doing, we were waiting for low tide along the Welsh coast, and I didn't do any sampling myself along the Somerset coast, but I did liaise very closely with colleagues in citizens groups down there. So I did the Welsh coast, and the colleagues did the Somerset coast.
How many people were involved, and when were the samples taken?
The samples were taken this summer, June and July, and just before the second round of dumping took place at Portishead. I think there were a team of four on the Somerset coast who took samples as far east as Bristol Docks and the River Avon and the shoreline immediately, well, as closely adjacent to the Portishead dump site as we could get. And that was before any dumping at Portishead. Colleagues and I took four samples from the Welsh side because we wanted to get, so we took less from the Welsh side than from the Somerset side because we'd already had a dump in Wales. But after the fuss that had been made on the Welsh side by over 150,000 signatories to petitions and so on and so on, the EDF decided that they would dump on the Bristol side instead at Portishead. So we really wanted to nail pre-dump data along that stretch of the Somerset coast. So we had seven samples.
It's fascinating. The idea that this dumping was going to be originally done on the Welsh side of the Bristol Channel, the north side, and then the Welsh Parliament and various activists in Wales started kicking off about it. And so instead, I suppose, people might see it as the soft touch. They decide, oh, we're going to dump it over at Portishead instead. So this just sounds to me as if they don't quite really know what they're doing.
There's some interesting coincidences, let's put it that way. When EDF came to Wales and made their first application for permission to dump that waste, actually the environment minister at the time was an ex-senior employee of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Agency. He had been head of PR, and also at that time the old Welsh Environment Agency had been closed, and the new Welsh EPA, which is called Natural Resources Wales, had not yet been opened. So there was a kind of hiatus there. And the minister signed the permit, and then basically, as far as we understand it, delivered it to Natural Resources Wales to manage the dredging action, but not to, predetermine the decision, because that had already been made by the minister. So, and then we had all this stuff where we won the debate in the National Assembly. But the minister, a second minister, a different minister by then, granted the license, the reapplication. Oh God, it's complicated. The license lapsed because actually the original license was granted in 2013, and then it lapsed and it came back in 2017 for renewal. So there was a second minister and she granted that license then. And then a companion group called Geiger Bay raised some money and took a court case and basically proved under law that probably EDF should have carried out an environmental impact assessment for that dump in Cardiff. And that would have covered all the baseline data that I was asking for. And so I think you're quite right in postulating that EDF had found it a difficult wicket to bat on and thought they would go to Somerset, where the nuclear power station was contributing a lot of support and finance and work to local people down there.
Seven River, just shift this mud around wherever it feels like. It almost seems a little bit pointless taking all this mud around when you might find that the river and the estuary will then just shift it back wherever it feels like over the next few years.
Well, you got a point there. I mean, there are three or four notable sediment deposits in the Inner Bristol Channel and the Severn Estuary. There's one in Bridgewater Bay, which the Hinkley reactors, the four currently operating Hinkley reactors, discharge into. And then there's another one on the Welsh side at a place called Usk Deeps or Newport Deeps. And as you will know yourself, if you've had a look, I mean, the entire coastline of the Inner Bristol Channel and Severn Estuary is like 90% deep, fine sediment. And you're quite right. The turbulent movements of tide and current and wind and the residual water movements does transport sediment around. But I guess the point is, from EDF's point of view, that once they've dug the big hole and stuck their pipelines into it, because that's what the hole is for, it's for the cooling water intakes and the radioactive effluent discharge pipelines. Once the pipes are in there, they don't care if it's covered up again. That's all right.
Okay, so I see the point now, I suppose, which is just to make a big hole for a short period of time, get the pipes in, and then it can be covered up. But anyway, maybe you could just explain because I mean, I would absolutely dread the prospect of wading out onto the mud right the way down towards the low water mark at low water. I don't imagine I would ever manage to make it out there or get back. How on earth do you get out on that mud?
Well, we went out as far as was humanly possible. So we were, that's why we were working in, not in single individuals. So somebody sits on the bank, with a camera. GPS's and photographs the action taking place, and somebody else with welly boots or waders on goes out as far as is feasibly possible without getting stuck, and takes a sample. So we were taking 400 to 500 gram samples, which is about a normal jam jar size, and then so we've got the GPS. We know exactly where it is, and we can replicate the site in future years. We've got our sediment samples in a sterilized glass jar with a sealed top, and then you can move on and do the next one. Should you find yourself getting stuck in the mud, you've got a person on the shore with a mobile phone who, should such an embarrassing situation occur, can phone the Coast Guard or the rescue choppers or whatever and get you out.
Do you lose any of your citizen science radioactivity surveyors in this process?
No, everybody survived. And on the other side, with the seven sites that they monitored there, they were two teams of two and sometimes a team of four. Working together.
Well, maybe you can go into a bit about these radionucleotides. So these are basically isotopes which are radioactive, which are produced as a kind of side effect of the nuclear power stations there. Some of them are particularly nasty, toxic. The body will bring them in and think that they're something useful, stick them in important parts of the body where they then start shoving out neutrons or whatever it is they do. Can you just tell us about some of those and what kind of radiation you're looking for, you know, whether it's alpha, beta, gamma radiation?
Yeah, well, we followed the some of the protocols done by EDF because we didn't want to start looking for radioactivity that they hadn't analyzed for in the mud they were going to dredge. We just wanted to do a comparison with their results. Now, there were, so we looked for cesium-137, which is a fission product, and we looked for americium-241, and both of these can be analyzed using the least expensive method. So we analyzed for gamma emitters, and both cesium and americium-241 are gamma emitters, and that is actually the most financially accessible, i.e. cheapest, form of analysis to do. But what we did do, I had submitted in my various submissions with previous stages of the campaign lots of academic reports from peer-reviewed journals and from university professors, saying that actually when you do gamma analysis, the longer you do it for, the more accurate and precise your readings will be. And then we noticed that EDF were counting, doing their gamma counts for only 15 hours. And the academics were saying, well, you want to be doing multiples of days, really, to get the most precise. So we took our samples and sent them away to a fully qualified and registered laboratory in France, which was set up by Greenpeace after the Chernobyl incident, and got them to do gamma counting for cesium-137 and americium-241 for 84 hours, which is 3 days. And lo and behold, we got some very interesting and effective results. Now, cesium is a fission product, so it's a byproduct of the nuclear fission reaction. Americium is a product of the burning of uranium fuels, and absolutely invariably, americium-241 is an indicator of alpha plutoniums. So alpha emitters don't penetrate the skin very much, and they don't have a very long range radioactive ray, as it were. But should you actually get them inside you by inhaling them or you know, eating them by some process, then they are very dangerous.
Like, for example, via a fish or a whelk or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And my big field of interest and expertise with radioactivity is actually the sea-to-land transfer of radioactivity. And there's a lot of academic work out there to show that this is a very significant supplier of dose to coastal populations who don't even necessarily have to be having anything to do with the shore or even eating seafood. There are a number of very, very well-reported studies which show that in some places where people are exposed to sea-to-land transfer along coastal strips, people who don't eat fish can actually have higher doses of dietary sea radioactivity because it's blown inland and landed on their vegetables and their agricultural products. So they can get bigger doses than seafood eaters can from marine radioactivity, but from terrestrial produce. So that's what we were doing. We were taking those things. Because our analysis was 84 hours, we actually got positive results for the americium, whereas the EDF work that was only doing 15-hour counts was getting less vans because their 15-hour count had a limit of detection, and they got to the limit of detection, and then at that stage they had no record of radioactivity because their count wasn't able to detect the lower levels of plutonium.
Isn't that handy? I mean, I've been following the work of Dr. Chris Busby for many years.
Ah, yeah.
And who's now, sadly, after a police raid and things like that, really felt it necessary to get out of the UK.
Yeah.
But I mean, what he managed to prove in the 1980s, I think it was in the 80s and 90s, was that although the government and the industry were both saying that these nuclear power stations were safe, they were, you know, very, of course, originally we were told this was going to be free energy. It turns out it's the most expensive way of producing energy known to mankind. But anyway, what Chris proved was that there were definitely leukemia clusters around these power stations, even though the government was denying it. So it shows really that the government really was just a kind of front, effectively, for the industry itself. And as you said, much of the impetus for this was about producing plutonium for nuclear weapons, really. Yeah. It was a kind of front for the military. But anyway, look, can you sum up what you found by doing all these samples around the you know, both sides of the Bristol Channel?
Okay. Well, I'll do my best to summarise, but I'll start off explaining the EDF statements, the nuclear industry statements. What they say is, as you've remarked, is harmless. Don't worry. The official monitoring carried out by the government with EDF's assistance, I think EDF do some monitoring with government money, and then government agencies like the Environment Agency do a bit of it as well. So what we have is that those annual reports produced under the aegis of the British government show that you got like double figures of cesium 137 and less than of americium 241 close to Hinckley, and then the further away you go from Hinckley, according to the official reports, the lower the levels of cesium 137 become, and you stay with less than of americium. So that's them using their 15-hour count, and they say, paradoxically, they say that the mud they're taking and going to dump is just the same as any other mud anywhere in the Bristol Channel. But yet the official figures, as I've just explained, actually show that, according to that, the further away you go, the lower the levels get. Further away from Hinckley you go, the lower the levels go. Now, what we found actually was that in some places downstream, and downstream in the Bristol Channel on the Somerset side is further east. So we had double figures all the way up. We didn't have any significant decline with distance from the Hinckley station. That's double figures for cesium. And we had positive, although admittedly low, but positive figures for americium. So definite presence, not less than, and therefore we don't know what's there. We can tell you what we've got at these various sites because we got the positive figures. The highest figures that we got on the Somerset side were actually in the Bristol Avon, in Bristol Docks, and on the shoreline at Portishead. And that was very interesting because those were as high as they were at the shoreline at Hinckley. Even more interesting, when we crossed the channel, and my samples that I took from the Welsh side, I took four. I took one by the Lower Severn crossing. I took one at a place called Goldcliff, another one at St. Bride's Light, just near the mouth of the River Usk, and another one in Cardiff Bay, about a mile away from the dump site. And all those figures, too, were double figures for cesium, i.e. above 10 becquerels to the kilogram, and positive actual figures for americium. But interestingly enough, although logically speaking, by going to Cardiff Bay, in theory, I was further downstream from Hinckley than any of the other sites, because actually the water in, oh God, I should have explained this in the beginning. The water in the Bristol Channel comes in along the Somerset coast and proceeds eastwards, and then up around about the area of the Severn crossing, actually the water crosses over and then proceeds westward along the Welsh coast. So in that context, the Cardiff Bay sample that I took should have been further away from Hinckley than the Severn crossing sample. But actually, of the Welsh samples, the one that had the highest readings was the one nearest the dump site, which had been used as the dump site for the up to 300,000 tonnes in 2018. And that offered a possible implication that that may have been an impact on the shoreline from the dumping that took place. But unfortunately, because we don't have a big ship with a deep, deep sediment corer, we couldn't monitor the Newport Deeps that I talked to you about earlier on, which is the big subtidal sediment deposit on the Welsh side. And so we couldn't compare that to what might, you know, as because that was where the authorities had posited very hesitantly that any movement of radioactivity would go from Cardiff Deeps up to the Newport Deep. But the Splott Bay, Cardiff Bay finding what was quite interesting, and it certainly indicated something which needs explanation from EDF and or the Welsh regulators or any other regulators who care to comment. And we're very open.
Would you like to speculate on the cause?
As I said, there's an implication that higher figure, because it was so close to the dump site that had been used in 2018, that there may have been an effect on the Cardiff shoreline indicated by that higher figure.
Also, I mean, it's great chatting with you because of your expert in the marine world, but I have noticed anecdotally chatting to people fishing along both sides that they say there's been a dramatic drop in the fish in the Bristol Channel. And I also was seeing, I think it was last year, Stop Hinckley were making a big fuss about the number of fish that were already being killed by the, and particularly by very, very young fish, the sort of little tiny ones you can hardly see being sucked in and basically mashed by this enormous great hoover of water that's being brought in to cool down the power station. Now, I wonder what you make of this, because it seems to me that although this is being put across as something quite positive for the environment, nuclear these days being carbon neutral, supposedly.
There are two stations there functioning at the moment using cooling water. They're both using millions of gallons a day. They have to suck it in under considerable power. They have got filters, and they do load the contents with biocide as it goes round to cool the reactors. So, yeah, you're quite right. It's already killing fish in multiples. We think that eggs and juveniles and fry are particularly at risk. We note that migratory fish of several species, some of which are getting increasingly rare, pass along that coast, past those things. They don't stop so long as the reactor's working. They've got to be sucking in those millions of gallons a day. The issue that I think you're thinking of was EDF had proposed a system called AFD, acoustic fish deterrent, which was going to make a noise which would frighten live and adult and active fish away from the intakes, and then they appear to have decided that that would be too expensive and too complicated, and so they went back again and asked the English Marine Management Organization for permission to chuck that idea out and put a less effective one in. That went to a small mini public inquiry, and we're still waiting for the result of that. But the fish and the marine environment are having big problems anyway without having systems like that put in. So you've got two pipelines sucking in that much at the moment. And now when Hinckley C goes on stream, you're off again.
What about the green argument? Because it seems to me that fish stocks in the natural marine environment in the Bristol Channel have been decimated.
Yeah, I think they have. I mean, there's a lot of industrial activity. There's been an enormous amount of aggregate dredging, a lot of fish use sand and gravel beds to lay their eggs in. There is increasing sedimentary disturbance, increasing nutrification because of agricultural and industrial activity along the shores of the Severn. Everybody really knows that the sea is in a hell of a mess.
Can you please try and just sum up what the results of this survey were, and also how people can find and follow Stop Hinckley?
Okay, well, there are websites. I don't personally have a website. Stop Hinckley has a website and a Facebook a website which can be found just by hunting for Stop Hinckley. Of course, I talk to them on a day-to-day basis, so I don't use their sites. My colleagues in the later formed Geiger Bay have a website, and we have an organisation called Severn Shield, which also has a website now. And Severn Shield are attempting to raise money for another court case to deal with the Hinckley issue. So there are some contacts that you can try and find. I can't give you any precise website addresses at this stage. Just to sum up, what we have demonstrated is that there are higher radioactivity counts at sites distant from the Hinckley reactor site. We have proved that before the dumping, there has been a history of radioactive contamination along both sides of the Severn, and that that should have been in, shouldn't have been left to poverty-stricken civilians to raise the money to do this kind of work when the nuclear industry is A, finding a cheap option for disposing of that radioactive mud, because it's widely agreed that they could store it on the land, but it would be a lot more expensive. So they've just done the usual thing, which people do use the sea as a dustbin, without considering the potential radiological impacts to coastal populations on both the Somerset coast and the Welsh coast. So we've shown that. We've shown that our 84-hour counts are more effective and more precise than the 15-hour counts that they were using. So essentially, what EDF and the British government have done for years is to underplay, by using the wrong methodology, they've underplayed the amount of radioactivity that coastal populations receive from nuclear radioactive effluent discharges to sea. We have got the baseline data that we wanted. So now, when the nuclear industry does its next dump at Portishead, we are in a position to see if they make it, if that dump makes a difference on the Portishead shoreline, as we have implications that it did on the Cardiff shoreline. The campaigns have certainly put up a very good fight to stop EDF from slipping out there, out from under their environmental obligations regarding fish exclusion devices. So if we manage to win that public inquiry, which cynically we suppose we won't, because we know that the government is bending over backwards to facilitate nuclear developments. And we suspect they'll find a way of thwarting our attempts there. But if we do win that public inquiry, we will at least get the best fish exclusion devices fitted to the intake pipes that we can. And we've got valuable data that otherwise the nuclear industry and the pro-nuclear government appear to not have wanted us to have. Where that takes us in terms of actually stopping the juggernaut, which is the nuclear industry, I'm not so sure. But I've referred that in terms of the public inquiry about the fish exclusion anyway. But at least we have been able to inform ourselves as campaigners, and the hundreds of thousands of supporters that we got for our various petitions, we have been able to provide them data. So they're now not living in a state of ignorance. As these things evolve, because as you know, there's a big push to start a new generation of nuclear power stations after Hinckley C. So hopefully people will be better informed and more able to provide empirical scientific data to warn of the potential impacts of this kind of activity. And it's very interesting, you know, because sea dumping of solid waste produced on land was stopped many years ago by the London Dumping Convention. And yet here we are with Hinckley, with EDF being able to mine up hundreds of thousands of tons of mud, which has got radioactivity in it. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And move it about and dump it somewhere else on somebody else's doorstep. Certainly the people of Wales were very annoyed to have Hinckley mud dumped a mile away from the Cardiff seafront. And I should imagine, well, I know that a lot of people in Portishead were very annoyed to be told that, hey, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of tons of this stuff dumped about 150 metres, yeah, about 150 metres off your shoreline at low tide. And so there we are.
Look, I mean, these are not exactly beautiful sandy beaches, are they, Tim?
No, agreed. But I mean, it is actually the other side of this is that the whole of the inner Bristol Channel and the Severn Estuary, the outer Severn Estuary, because of those mud banks, has been loaded with environmental protection designations. It's SACs, special areas of conservation, special protection areas, Ramsar sites, breeding sites for seabirds, feeding sites for various fish and seabird species, plants, and so on and so on. So
because the humans don't really like going swimming in mud, then that's actually been a bit of a haven for wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, we had a few years back, we had the whole of the very extensive Cardiff Bay harbour and intertidal unit was closed off by a barrage. And at that stage, we were told, oh, well, you know, don't worry, because all this huge variety of seabirds in particular that use the Cardiff Bay mud when the tide is out, they've got all that stuff up there to use, up eastwards, up towards the Severn Bridge and down on the Somerset side as well. And so that wildlife, which was excluded from Cardiff Bay because we had a barrage built and it's permanently flooded, we were told, oh, that they can go, you know, there's plenty of other room for it. And now we're having this radioactive sediment, which was locked into the Bristol, in the Bridgewater Bay sediments. It was there. It wasn't very nice, but it's, you know, Bridgewater Bay off the Hinckley site is widely understood to be a reservoir of marine pollutants of all sorts, because it's a place where fine sediment builds up over the decades, and a lot of marine pollution is chooses to associate with sedimentary particles which deposit out there. So it was sequestered. A lot of that stuff from the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, when discharge levels were higher than they are now, permitted discharge levels through the pipelines of radioactivity were higher then than they are now, that had all been buried in these sediments. Now this dredging is going down to 6 or 7 meters and bringing it all up and then carting it around and depositing it first of all off the Cardiff foreshore and now off the Bridgewater off the Portishead foreshore. So okay, it's
you pointed out something, which is the government's real enthusiasm for nuclear. Now I scratch my head when I hear this, because there are all sorts of very serious doubts about how green nuclear is. Certainly, it's not very good for the environment to have radioactivity, which lasts for tens of thousands of years. And also the massive expense in carting this mining this uranium, carting it around the world, the connections with the atomic weapons that are being produced as well, seems to make it an absolute no-no for anybody who's green with a brain cell.
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? But I mean, we are strongly aware of two things. I haven't done this myself, but other nuclear researchers have quoted statements from Ministry of Defence sources saying that it's essential to have a civilian nuclear reactor program going, because it trains up all your it provides the money and the university departments, etc. to fund the training of the nuclear weapons technicians, and it still produces, don't think Hinckley produces plutonium any longer for the weapons program, but there are other radioactive substances like tritium, which most of the UK reactors produce, which are always used, also used in the manufacture of bombs. So there is a very close need for the military system to have a civilian system to back it up and provide it with materials and technically qualified staff. And then secondly, you raised the issue about transporting uranium, and that brings me to the subject of the carbon-free claim for civilian nuclear power, which is really just a case of exporting the carbon to somewhere else. Now, Namibia, where the UK gets a lot of its uranium from, it has two big uranium mines and uranium refining facilities, but you need power to do that, and those are run by coal-fired power stations. So there's a hideous irony that we buy the uranium from the Namibians, and they're the ones who are producing all the carbon to refine and mill and mine that stuff. And then even when we've got our nuclear power stations running, certainly the current ones, the pressurized water reactors and the gas-cooled reactors that we are running at the moment in the UK, they produce other greenhouse gases other than carbon dioxide. So it's not climate friendly. And then you've got the whole big issue, you know, in order to run those damn things, you've got to be discharging, again, millions of gallons of radioactive effluent a day out of a nuclear power station into the water. You've got to be discharging thousands of cubic meters of radioactive gas into the atmosphere from those stations. And then in the long run, you still got to find a geological disposal facility to store all the highly active waste, which, as you said earlier on, is going to last for tens of thousands of years and be toxic, radiotoxic, and dangerous to be around. So, you know, it's not a problem free response. It's just one jump. Oh, here's a problem. Okay, so we avoid that problem by adopting this policy, and somewhere down the line we'll deal with the terrible potential impacts of the new policy. But really the main thing to do is to get rid of the current problem. It's really short-sighted and a kind of infantile view of long-term energy strategy to be applied.
Well, no, I mean, I think, that makes a lot more sense and hangs together as an argument far better than what I hear from the government and most of the press, actually, the mass media. We had all this amazing enthusiasm from the BBC at Points West when Hinkley C was announced. Then there's this kind of poison pill that actually it's going to be an offshoot of the Chinese government, effectively. Yes. It's sitting on our doorstep. But more importantly, a couple of months ago, there was rather a nasty problem over in Taishan in China, which is one of these identical designed reactors, an EPR type reactor, which is being built at Hinkley C. And I understand that actually that has meant that, this is a very new reactor in China and it's had to be shut down. Doesn't sound to me as if it bodes very well for whether the Hinkley C reactor, once it gets started, if it ever does get started up, is going to work very well. So how has this accident over in and failure of the reactor and shutdown over in China affecting what the prospects for Hinkley C?
Well, as far as we can see, to be honest with you, Tony, it doesn't seem to be having any impact at the government and the legislative and the regulatory end. I know that colleagues in other countries have been digging and delving and trying to find out exactly what was going wrong with that site, with that station. That station was built quite quickly. It was built... you could argue a case, if you were just after speed of build, that good old Chinese did it really well. You know, they did it fast and they did it quick. It could also be now, in light of what's happened there, proposed that they were cutting corners.
I've read in the Times, this is 10 days or so ago, that Hinkley C, the Chinese nuclear plant fault that's been discovered, may delay the opening date for Hinkley C, key safety components in the UK's first new nuclear power station for 30 years, may need to be redesigned and the project could be delayed. I mean, this just sounds to me like they're being told you're going to have to go back to the drawing board almost.
No, it's madness. I mean, what we're talking about here is a French-designed reactor. This is the European pressurized reactor, actually emanates from France, and they've had a lot of trouble with them because they've been trying to build one in Finland, and they've been building one in France as well, and they've had all sorts of problems. Reactor safety buildings have a massive concrete and welded metal cap that they put on top, to in case there is a nuclear explosion, in the hopes of holding everything within the pressure shell, sort of reinforced concrete. Now, the cap that they put on the French one, when they got it on, they then discovered that all the welds in the metal parts were cracked. And so they had to take it off again and redo the whole, re-weld the whole thing. The one in Finland, cause I'm not really so much into, the manufacturing side of reactors. My focus is the marine stuff. But I understand that the one in Finland, because of, building flaws and, design flaws, is now, many years late and many millions of whatever the Finnish currency is over budget. This comes back to when you look at how EDF at Hinkley C appear to be looking for money saving devices, like chucking the waste into the Bristol Channel rather than storing it on land in proper bunded sites, as you would do with anything else that was particularly polluted, where you can watch it and you can check it and you look after it for a few years until the levels have gone down, and then you can work out what to do with it. There's a lot here about money, and there's a lot here about haste. And the Chinese, because they went a bit faster than the British constructors did, I think they cut a few corners and they didn't get it quite as effective. Or else, as you implied, it's a basic design flaw and all of those EPRs being designed and built by EDF are going to have to be taken back to the drawing board and redone.
Wow, amazing. Anyway, Tim Dear Jones, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for a fine, robust and interesting interview. Bless you.